Julian, welcome to Writer's Series.
Thank you very much for having me.
Would you like to share with us how you were introduced to the craft of writing?
Well, it was more like it was an outlet for for a very traumatic experience. I started writing first after my father passed away, back in 2009. I started with poetry as a way to express myself. Like, I couldn't keep the grief bottled up, so I had to get it out on paper. And even if no one read it, it still felt good because now it was no longer in here. Now it was out in there.
Prior to your personal experience with starting with the poetry, how did you view writing? Was it part of your academic career? Did you look forward to it?
It was, I guess it was just something I've always, like seeing people do. Like, I've read a bunch of books. Like, the authors of Christopher Paolini, he did the Inheritance Cycle, one of my favorite authors. And then, of course, I've read all the Harry Potter books in one summer. And I just like it sparked the imagination, but it didn't steer the ship. I've always been, interested in it. I mean, I've always been creative when I was a kid, like always like writing down concepts and ideas for stories and even just creative elements. But I guess I actually went to a Comic-Con once and I met a few authors. I even met someone who brought up the website CreateSpace that used to be on Amazon. He suggested it, and well, I've already, believe it or not, written like a couple stories, just via Microsoft Word and all that. It was like just because I wanted to start doing it, and once it was out there in writing, I guess I finally worked up the courage after a lot of procrastination.
Should I ask you how you procrastinated? Because I've heard some writers talk about putting some things off.
Well, I guess you could say that's my writing style. I don't like to, set myself like you're gonna get up and do things like per a schedule. If I do that, I'm more like, oh, I don't want to do it at all. So I do it when I want to. Like, and that way the words flow like a river. I'm able to focus in the moment because if you try to force it, you're not gonna get anywhere.
I agree. I've heard from writers that sometimes when you procrastinate, it becomes a question of do you really have the desire to write or not? Now, the Divine Crusade is a four-part book series. When you started with
Four for
one,
now. I've written four books, but there are two more to go. They're already written. It's all just a matter of dosh.
when you
Simply
started
put.
out with the first one, did you know there were going to be multiple that would follow?
Oh yes. When I first wrote it, I then like wondered like, this is a story that's too big for one book. And so after four published books, two more, and even I'm working on another series to continue this book series. Let's just say I've been quite proactive in continuing my chaotic train of thought.
Do you let inspiration drive your writing? Do you seek out the inspiration?
Say it's a combination. You see, I do a lot of I play a lot of video games, watch a lot of movies, TV shows, and oftentimes I'm always and every day digesting stories that people come up with. I'm not plagiarizing them, but I like to see the little things and then take them and make my own spin of it, just as any self-respecting author would do. Copying is not a nice.
I'm glad that you mentioned video games because when I was reading the overall descriptions of each of the books that are out there at the moment, from Airborne, Landfall, Vigilance, and Galvanic Eruption, the first thing that came to my mind was this would make a great video game.
Well, that's kind of what was the inspiration for a lot of it. Like I said, I played a lot of video games ever since I got my first N64 back in 1999. I loved it because what better story than one you get to be an active driver of rather than just the audience, which is what it is for books.
Very true. And because you write fiction, how do you describe the hybrid of fantasy fiction? Because it seems there's also science at play.
Oh yes. Well, that's the thing. If you want to write a story about a world that breaks the conventions of the re of real, create a new universe. And that's what I've kind of done. I've created a new universe where it allows for this craziness of storytelling. And that's what every author who, does a story that's not based on Earth is. That's what Marvel and DC do.
Well, when absorbing the descriptions of the book, I will say it appeared that you apply a layered approach of exploring the human condition, that underneath there's layers and layers within us, even the characters that you start peeling off like an onion.
Well, that is one example. People are we have just as we have there are many forms of us. We are each a different person in different situations. And my characters go through quite the transformation. Can I use some examples?
Sure.
One of them would be Sifro. He's one of my main characters, as you've probably read in my synopses. He started this journey as a pacifist in a world of war. And in that regard, he was considered less than dog meat because in a world that values warriors, pacifists are considered second-class citizens. But he chose this for himself because he saw his mother die before him horribly. And because of that, he had to put up with a lot of hatred and as an orphan of, and let's just say he didn't, put it in the most healthy of way. One time actually in the story, people killed, but he basically he's an ring whiz. He set up a academic test which requires proficiency in weaponry and vehicles. Because it's a world of war, you need to know how to do things to survive. He set up it up in such a way that aristocrats who had been bullying him all of his time there failed their tests. In doing so, were grievously wounded or killed themselves because they didn't know how to operate the machinery. Like I said, not the healthiest way to deal with bullies, but what are you going to do when everyone hates you for not wanting to fight? Then later on, he becomes a he. Like becomes a driver of such a weapon of war and even becomes a leader of a large army. But that's because he learned that you have to sacrifice your pacifism for the sake of survival. Because being a pacifist is all well and good when it is respected, but when it's not respected, you are just an easy target. So Sifro had to learn that the hard way. And because of that, it made him a more balanced individual, a work in progress made whole.
You also present the environment to be a balance between chaos and peace. And peace cannot exist without chaos.
Exactly. That's a big thing in my stories, duality. War and peace, light and darkness, good and evil, all of it. Sifro on a way. Each just to represent different things.
Is there wordplay when you came up with the character's name, Sifero?
Yeah, if you're thinking like a just because you see the name or the word hero in his name, does not make him the hero. I just thought of it and it came to mind and it sounded really good. So I stuck with it.
Can you speak on the character of Isha?
She's an interesting case. She grew up in this world of peace as a part of an institution that Sifro hates, nobility. However, suffers it just the same. Her own family wanted her to, marry into, I guess, like another royalty to increase the status of her family. But she chafes against it and once wanted to run away. That's how she met Sifro. And the meeting of those two is what caused a paradigm shift in the entirety of their worlds. Because as the story goes on, she saw how horrible and monstrous the upper echelon is. And how they're willing to stop at nothing to kill and destroy anything that gets in their way, so long as they're able to maintain their power. While Sifro has to come to terms with his background of, living in a world of war. He had, like I said, sacrificed his pacifism for the sake of survival. And however, he decided to stick to do things his way and no one else's. lead in a manner he can be proud of.
Because you reference nobility, the greater question could be, Sephiroth's questioning nobility. Is there such a thing as a person being too noble?
Noble in the sense of
A character, meaning a person being too good to be true. How do you define nobility?
I define nobility by the to use a line from a movie. What was it? The Kingsman, about nobility. Nobility isn't about being superior to your fellow man, but superior to your former self. Sifro became superior to his former self as the pacifist by becoming more balanced. Moesha became superior to herself by casting off her naivete and taking up a warrior's station for the sake of changing their worlds.
Your book series that runs a little bit parallel to, let's say, the storytelling in video game. The writing could turn into an indefinite in adventure, right?
But all adventures have to come to an end. For now, you have another two books to look forward to.
True. And it ties back to a comment that you made earlier that had to do with the upper echelon, the powerful people going out and destroying things and lands that get in the way of their agenda. What is there left to rule and have power over if enough people are dead and all the land is destroyed? Does that mean it's game over or you just move on to another universe?
Nope, it's still I'll be taking place on that world. All that once you eliminate the ones in power, it's up for whoever's left to rebuild and rebuild a better world, one that casts off the hatred and disgust that these people in upper echelons are trying to use to control everyone. Maybe I should mention the enemy faction. You have a better perspective, though. I think I should mention Sifro and Oesha are not human. That is important to broach. Sifro is a Terran. He's as human as they come, but he grew up in a world of war, so they're ever a greasy, grimy, stalwart, and hearty people willing to crack skulls and fight beside each other. While Oesha is a winged. They're basically an angelic people who literally have wings. So they might look like angels, but they're furthest from angels you'll ever come across. And because of that, I'm sure you can see the differences between them. Sifro, in his world, you are valued as for being a soldier and not for being a pacifist. But that's it. There are no other racial constraints. There's no issues about ethnicity or any of that. It's a quite a fair world, but like I said, one decision is all it takes to change that. And for Wesha, she lives in a world that values the quality of one's wings. So because of that, it's a medieval society that has developed a caste system. People have like all kinds of wings, bird wings, bat wings, dragon wings, even insect wings like butterflies and whatnot. It's a very quite varied world. You even have those who have composite wings, like made out of like a gar like a like like a whole garden, or even made of like metal, and you even and the at the tippy top of that, you have the white wings and the Engria. The white wings, quite literally, being those with the white wings, but they're considered a birth defect that has been heightened to the echelon of upper nobility. Well, the Engria are basically people who have attained a sort of like heightened enlightenment. They have wings made out of every element you can imagine: fire, lightning, ice, mist. They're quite literally seen as demigods. However, you also have those who don't have any wings at all, and those are called the wingless. They're considered the dog meat equivalent of a pacifist, and they are essentially 75% of the population. Because of that, they are butchered by the upper half, sorry, by the upper echelon, like every like a few decades. It's terrible and cruel, but that's just the world of peace they live in. Sometimes you don't have a choice but to endure the peace.
So for the caste system that is infused in Avisha's society, is there a way of overcoming the caste system, or does everybody remain within their lane?
There is, but it's rare. Like a wingless can become an Engria, but it requires like a like self like great self epiphany, but it's almost never happens. While it's really easy for someone who is an avia, which basically means a bird wing, to become wingless. All you got to do is get a wing chopped off. That happens all the time because it's medieval society, so plenty of duels, plenty of fights, plenty of, well, a lot of stuff happening. And there's no way to recover from that. Once you're wingless, you're that forever. Or you can become a compa, which is basically you only have one wing cut off. You can still fly, but it's difficult. Like it's like walking with a splint or a like crutch. You can still do things, just not as well.
Is there any way for Sephiroth to redeem himself in his society and for Avesha to redeem herself in her society?
It's not so much about redeeming themselves. They're trying to save their worlds from destruction. I apologize if I misconstrued details. They're quite literally like what they're up against are religious zealots, warmongering industrial complexes, slavers, warlords, all that jazz. It's not just a fight to deal with the upper echelons. They're also fighting, well, weapons of mass destruction, gods. It's a hectic, crazy story with a lot of depth and a lot of layers.
Speaking of layers, because they're fighting against several groups at the same time, and each group has different objectives, how does the relationship between Sephiroth and Avesha evolve? Because when you spend plenty of time coexisting with another person, regardless of their attributes, there are going to be differences. There is going to be conflict. There is going to be emotions, even though they are not human. Are they able to feel given their respective biology?
Oh yes, they feel. They start off as like as simply like, you know, like friends and compatriots fighting for this a noble cause. Then Oesha slowly falls in love with him. Their relationship is built upon a bond of trust and respect, but also of difference. Because Sifro was seen as a pacifist, Oesha was often belligerent or combative towards that nature because she fought for the things she believed in. So there were even times when she would attack him for no reason other than just the simple fact that she didn't want him to be a pacifist anymore. It doesn't mean that she hates him. It's just she's testing him in a world that values peace and well, superiority to your fellow. She wanted him to be strong but didn't respect his values.
When she was testing him, was she consciously testing him or testing him based off her actions?
She was testing him. It doesn't happen very often, like once or twice, but she was trying to get him to conform to her ideals. And yet he can't because, well, it's his own trauma. He in the first books, he can't conform it because it's just not him. He's more than happy to fix things and ensure and give people a fighting chance, but he's not much. He doesn't want to fight much himself. Even in like later parts of my first book, he's the only person who's using a non-lethal weapon in the middle of a war zone, as opposed to other people with an who are trying to kill him. It's a compromise. He doesn't kill outright, but he's making it hard. He deals with the foe in his own way.
Are there any occurrences of a status quo in your storytelling? Throughout all of the book series, there's always some form of conflict or hurdle to overcome. Are there any peaceful moments?
I would say the peaceful moments are the moments when you're not fighting. I mean, there are definitely moments in and out stories where people have or basically have time to catch their breath, to like dwell upon what the actions of what's happened, do some exploration, learn some forgotten history, and get a greater grasp upon the foundations of the worlds. Definitely, it happens. It's just that's what people seem to forget about war. It's not always fighting. Like there are plenty of times when people like will spend days when they're not fighting. Like they'll just be in the trenches sleeping or like spending time with family. Or not every just because you live in a world of war doesn't mean everyone is a warrior. There are plenty of people who fight in militias. Plenty of people who work in factories. Plenty of people who serve others. Not everyone's a warrior, but everyone does their part.
How do you define the word war in the context of your artistic craft?
War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. That's tricky. War is the conflict of ideals and not just arms and armies. People who are so stubborn and set in their ways that the average person stops mattering. You become an obstacle to their plans and designs. And the only way to deal with that obstacle is to remove it. War is conflict. It's death and destruction, but it's also respect and honor for those who practice it.
Even though when people think of war, there's destruction and chaos, at the same time, do you imagine that there's a certain level of discipline that exists within the people who are engaged in that war?
Yes. I mean, discipline is the foundation of any military. A respect to the chain of command, a belief in what you're fighting for. Discipline is one of the foundations. And if you don't have discipline, things can fall apart pretty quickly.
During times of war, how can one know who to trust, what to trust?
That's all back to the old ideal of the fog of war. War is, you could say, a force of nature. But a man-made force of nature, a storm of steel, mud, and blood. It's a terrible thing, but it's also a necessary thing because when worlds fail us, the fists will fly. I mean, look, I'm not trying to say that I support war and want it to happen, but I accept the fact that it has happened and that despite all the terrible things that it's caused, it's also caused some good.
Well, it does exist in the background noise, whether it's in within our social culture, arts, entertainment, books that get written, video game, whether you're watching a fictional show. So it's intertwined in our human existence, but to resort to it when needed. By book three, The Vigilance, Severo and Avacia's relationship does get tested, but you also explore the concept of conflict. How do you define conflict, and how do you weave that into your storytelling?
Well, conflict in a conceptual format is anyone engaging with words or with fists. I guess it's all about engagement, really. But from like simple actions, like from like you and I him simply having a conversation, you could say there is conflict over the simple use of words, just as there is conflict like from people engaging in a war of trade or even of ideals or weaponry. Conflict happens in all its forms, but and in ways we don't think of on the usual. But your question was like how I weave it into my stories.
Because
I guess.
conflict is a healthy element. I view conflict to be a healthy element. Context matters. Some people run from conflict in among humans because they view it as it's a bad thing. Having a difference, a possible difference or intellectual difference means that's where their engagement ends with any other human being or their environment. But conflict is something that could also give a boost to one's performance, their existence.
Conflict is inevitable. No, you have two choices. Either you face it or you run from it. If you face it, then you are made better, made stronger, made wiser. But if you run from it, you will eventually have to face it. Because no matter how far you run, no matter how many rocks you hide under, it'll just keep building and building until you're forced to face it, be you prepared or unprepared. So conflict is inevitable. It's a driving force of life, like chaos and peace is. But it's all about finding the balance, your own balance, as opposed to someone else's balance.
For someone who wouldn't know how to define balance, is there a starting point for that?
I'm not exactly an expert on this, but I can give my best case for it. Balance isn't what you say, like the stalemate of good versus evil. War versus chaos. It's something that you find for yourself, emotionally, physically, cognitively, spiritually. It's about finding yourself, but in a way that is outside of anyone's influence or determination. It is your choice that matters most. Because if you don't have the ability to choose, you might as well be dead. I mean, and that sounds extreme, but we live in a world where people don't have a choice. often. And to have the ability to choose even something so minuscule and minor is in itself a victory.
Very wise words, and people at times take the gift of free will for granted. For those who have it, and they're waiting for someone else or a third party to make decisions for them.
Which is why you can't rely upon someone else to make those decisions for you. I mean, I'm talking like big ones, like that affect many people, but like just like little choices you make on in your life, like what food you eat, what like how far you walk in a day, or even like what am I going to say to a loved one? It's those little choices that you can't take for granted. Each one of those that you make is a victory or a defeat. It's all dependent upon the self.
We're going to take a step back and focus on some writing prompts. When you are creating characters, what goes through your mind? Because these characters are so layered, there has to be a seed that gets planted and then you start fertilizing it.
Well, I like to say that my character creation process, rather than farming, is more like a mad scientist experiment. I literally ping pong ideas through my brain here and there. Like I've created some crazy characters. Like one of my favorite ones I created was in book two, a lady called a aristocrat called Noriz. She was an aristocrat that engages in sky piracy. She captured Sifro and forced him to work for her as a contracted gladiator after he had acquired a weapon of war. But things didn't exactly go her way. She was so sure of herself, she wasn't expecting Sifro to make her fall flat on her face. Just because he outsmarted her, that's all.
Would you call that to be a comic relief character?
Not necessarily. Like she has her own development. She just didn't know who she was dealing with. She thought he was another, just another sell a person mercenary willing to sell his soul for cash, or someone she could manipulate into doing whatever she wanted. But it's oftentimes it's back to like that the ideal of nobility believing they can do whatever they want without human or common decency. That is oftentimes what people seem to forget. That just because someone is lower than you of station does not mean you can treat them however you want. Restraint and humility are important in life.
Those two will take you further in life. Have you ever encountered where you created more characters than you needed? Or do you create characters as you feel you delegate a purpose to them?
I think I have done that a few times. Like there were characters that I've had to delete from my story, but just because like when I was writing, roughly, I wanted them in like just to add greater depth to certain characters. But then when I handed it over to an editor, they helped me see clearly on the why certain characters weren't needed. And then I just adjusted accordingly.
Let me see if I could pronounce it properly. German guard?
Jormungandr. If you're wondering, that's based off the world serpent from Norse mythology.
And the other location is Stratus. So when you started building these two worlds, what was the very first thought that went through for the first one and the second one?
Well, for Jormungandr, I wanted it to sort of be a reflection of our own world. Jormungandr is a sort of a reflection of Earth. Earth is 72% water. Jormungandr is 72% land. So you could say it is a bit of a flip on that. Like, what would it be like to live in a world where there's more land than there is water available, where the rest is either in lakes and underground reservoirs, and everything else is just mountains, canyons, and mesas, as well as plenty of flatlands. Now, what's unique about Jormungandr is that the Terrans who live there, they fought in four world wars, each time technology evolving, towards the process of war, but not in the other ways. But that's not necessarily a bad thing all the time, because a lot of the things that we've created, like for ourselves, would only have been possible if not for war. Like the internet, that was originally built for the military, but it didn't really have any use, so the civilians got it. And for Stratus, I wanted to do like I guess back to that whole duality thing. Jormungandr is Earth, Stratus is sky, another element like the primordial elements of fire, water, earth, and air. Stratus is, like I said, the duality of war, but it's peace. And peace is a wonderful thing. Everyone wants peace. Everyone wants to be able to just do what they want without anyone influencing them. That is what peace is supposed to be. But it's also stagnation. If you're not allowed to do some things that you know would improve your life, things that might be chaotic and not lead to anything, then what's the point of living peacefully if nothing changes?
I love that you point out the stagnation part. As you were speaking, it got me thinking if we're living in a peaceful existence, there might be a point we reach where we go, okay, what comes next? There has to be something to strive for.
Exactly.
How do you define the word challenge? Because there are plenty of challenges that are placed in your stories that the characters have to navigate.
So I would say necessary obstacles, because and it's just a part of the character development. We come to care about characters whom are we torture, we put them through traumatic situations, we force them to rethink what they know about themselves and their worlds, and just it might be just be for entertainment, which sounds absolutely terrifying and harsh, but it's necessary. Because it's like back to the stagnation. If you only read about a character that does things and they succeed at it, then what's the point of reading about that character? Because we want to relate to them. We want to put ourselves in their shoes and relate to them in a way that makes sense. Because every character you read about is essentially a mimic or a reflection of someone who exists in real life, not with like the same powers or same reputation, but just a facsimile of what has already come before. And we like to be put in those situations as long as we're not actually having to go through it physically.
With all the characters that you've created, and because you're writing a hybrid version of fiction, have you ever had characters that died, but they came back later in time in a different form or as themselves?
Yes, one every now or so. But I believe that's a you should use that very sparingly. Because if every character who died and came back later happened all the time, well, that's a great way to either hook people or lose people. You have to know, just as much as I like to take a chaotic approach to writing, meaning like I have no idea what I'm going to put on paper the next day and just let it flow like a river. I also have to be careful because sometimes I can get myself in trouble. I can accidentally write a situation for a character that makes no sense later on, or it might not make sense to an editor. The point simply is you just gotta be aware that it can happen. Adapt accordingly.
On rare occasions when that has happened, was that solely for the sake of reincarnation, or you discovered that there might be a need for that character to return?
I think, like in some cases, there was a character or so that I believed would be important to the story, or like to explore character arcs that have yet to be explored for someone. It creates new situations that we can enjoy and relate to, because you could say it's a part of the process of a character exploration. Like the orphan who does not know his family, either is reunited with his family that abandoned him, or finds a new one in the process, or learns about how he can no longer ever see them again. Different avenues create different scenarios for people to explore these characters. And it's kind of fun to sort of like, look at the paths that you could potentially set a character down and then follow one that makes the most sense to you regarding the story.
Let's focus on collaborations because you do have an editor and you also had an artist for the illustrations, the illustrator. What was your experience like when you brought the first manuscript to the editor? And what have you learned about your writing in the process?
Well, I haven't used the same editor every single time. Oftentimes I would just, hire someone like through LinkedIn or other websites. So, and even my own family have actually helped me with my editing and illustrations. My first and second book that I have, my sister created the cover of Airborne. Now understand, first book, so it's sort of like it was the trial run, the place you make the mistakes, or even in like final form. But still, publishing a book for the first time, not something everyone does.
When you receive edits or recommendations, how do you navigate knowing, okay, these are legit, I'll think about it and I'll make the changes. And these I don't quite agree with because it's my story, and maybe the editor doesn't understand the idea I'm displaying.
All the time, all the goddamn time. I'll admit, it's difficult to have your work criticized by someone else. Maybe criticize isn't the right word. To have them go over it and say, this doesn't work.
A critique.
Exactly. It's it makes me want to do unspeakable things to that individual. Not in a bad way, it's just like you. When you write a story, it becomes your baby. Like you want people to have the same respect for you did, rather than to come through there with a sledgehammer and steamroller.
In terms of your editors, are they general editors or do they edit solely for your genre of work?
Say I've mostly been general editors. It's just kind of like I think like a general editor is more beneficial than specific genre editor because they bring the most important thing to any manuscript, the general audience that doesn't know the entirety of things. Being able to get that perspective is very, very useful because oftentimes the people who are picking up your books don't know which way is up or down. And so being able to sort of ground your story in that way can really help in the long run. I mean, yeah, sure, you're going to still talk about things that are only relevant if you've read previous books in the series. But, adjusting it ever so slightly in just way, like explaining things a little more in depth that might need the explanation, or pointing fingers at specific events that are crucial can help people still have an interest in it. Like it's just the little things that you gotta pay attention to. And having editor, go through my work with a fine-tooth jagged edge comb, if you will, is well, I might not hate it, but often I might hate it, but oftentimes he might have a point.
Are they able to follow logic in the context of the storytelling? I
And the
think they're
plot?
looking at the flow because logic would be a mouthful when we're talking about alternate realities, alternate species. And some editors may not have that expansive imagination because they might be looking at it solely through the lens of writing.
Oftentimes people who have read my stories say that they were very well written, even for a rough draft. Oftentimes, yeah, they can follow the logic. I guess that's probably because you've mentioned before, I write my stories like I'm writing a video game. And in a way, video games oftentimes have a lot of pretty clear structure. So I guess because I play a lot of video games and know how they work in terms of like their plot and character creation and all that I already have a foot in on what to do right and wrong.
What writing tip would you have for a new writer out there who might have all the passion and excitement to write a multi-book series, but they haven't gotten to writing book one to know what may transpire? Because passion is not always enough to produce a piece that has utility value other than for the author.
I would say, well, it's a lot of things, really. Look at your world, and if there's something you see there that doesn't make a lot of sense to you, something either you hate it, you love it, it makes you literally peel away your skin because you're so aggravated by it. Anything that really like for me, my process was I is video games and movies, and looking at the concepts that people have written about. And then trying to break away from that pattern. But everyone is different. I mean, everyone, look at your passions, look at your hobbies, look at even look at the things that your family does. Inspiration can come from anywhere, and I mean anywhere. You just have to have the ability to like look at it and say, aha, because the stories can, like, the stories you can write can pretty much be anything. I mean, like, I've had ideas like swimming around. I always have ideas swimming around in my head on other stories I could write, like a sort of like horror story based in our real world, where the diseases that people like, well, not diseases, but like vampirism, lycanthropy is treated as a actual treatable disease, and you people have various symptoms regarding it. Or I don't know, like you ever heard of the movie Wild Hogs that had Tom Hanks in it?
Yes.
That inspired me with the idea of creating a story about like a bunch of motorcycle gangs that all exist in like one area, and they each have their own like sort of like motivations, all sort of vying for control. These are all ideas that I've just sort of played around with and never written down, but it's just, you should allow yourself to have a little bit of chaos in your mind. Just play around with things, make mistakes, and don't really care about who you offend, because you're going to offend someone regardless of whether you intend it to or not. Like I said,
Oh, go on.
it just has to be, you have to, it's like a river. You have to let it flow.
You said it best. When you started writing, were you writing for yourself or did you already have an audience in mind?
I think I already had an audience in mind. I wanted to write for war veterans and volunteers of war. Basically, I have the utmost respect and love for veterans because they've done so much for us that we will never stop thanking them for what they've done. And oftentimes they don't get recognized for their contributions. The peace that we have is thanks to them, and nobody talks about it. Everyone's just sort of happy to, like X their lives away or just work away. I just feel like more recognition needs to be given to veterans, because without them, you and I would be out there fighting for everyone else's thankless peace.
You said it best because your testimony resonates with me. We'll say that not enough recognition is channeled towards veterans, and this should go beyond the resources and the holiday that gets delegated in their honor. That more should be done, and I'm glad that you're raising awareness of that. And more people need to become self-aware why they're living a comfortable, peaceful life, regardless of how they feel about their own life. The fact that you could walk out and go about your day for most people is a blessing.
People seem to forget that World War I was, you literally had children joining the military because they wanted to fight alongside their friends. And as horrible as that sounds, it's also a very human thing to just want to be with your friends in any situation.
We're going to briefly focus on the world of words. What is one word that you use a lot in your writing?
Defiance.
What is one word that you feel it is a good time to retire it from your writing?
I don't think, I mean, that word, you think I should retire it?
If it works for you, you should not retire a word that
I
has
don't
a
think,
functional value.
well, that's actually one of the core tenets of my stories, defiant hope. Not just, hope for a better tomorrow, fighting for that hope. Because it's just, I think that's what humanity is in a nutshell, defiant hope. Because we're always striving, fighting, and working towards something. No matter how many times the world gets us down, how many times we're beaten to our knees or told we're not allowed to do things in a particular way, people who look them in the eye and say, "You're wrong. We will never conform to your ways because your ways are wrong. We will never accept your ways because we have found our own way." And that is how we are defiant.
And as we start to wind down, are there any activities or interests that you participate in that help you refine your creative writing?
I like to create concepts for video games, believe it or not. I've spent a lot of time on Reddit and other websites writing fan fictions, if you will, of like certain video games or movies that I've enjoyed. Because Like, I guess that's a big thing in stories. It's important to have vagueness in a story. Vagueness becomes a hole that you can fill with new stories and new characters. So, and that's why it's important to write a story, but also to leave gaps that you can fill in later.
And finally, is there any life mystery you would like to explore in possibly a future writing? Because you do such a great job helping people escape into this fictitious worlds that exist out there.
Explorations.
Or experiments, in your word.
I would say, nothing really comes to mind at the moment, but I would say people standing on their own without certain institutions. I'm not going to say what they are, but we all sort of like, have certain institutions that we put our faith in, but oftentimes all that we've ever needed is faith in ourselves.
I like that because I often encourage people before relying on anything outside of you, not to initiate a godlike complex. You should learn who you are, what you believe in, before start connecting the dots and the threads of humanity outside of you. Finally, Julian, it is a pleasure to be in your presence. How can readers and writers connect with you?
Well, you can go on Amazon. I have 4 books of my Defiant Crusade series up there, along with a Christmas story that is a regular fiction that called Mentors and Mavericks, if people want just a simpler, less complicated story about the Nutcracker. You can also find me on LinkedIn. I'm also on Facebook, but I don't really use social media a whole lot. Other times you can just I've even appeared on a podcast on YouTube. Cool. So I guess yeah, I'm on YouTube as well. So I don't really frequent social media much. I like to keep to myself, but I love to share stories and tell tales.
Wonderful, and we look forward to learning the other two books that shall follow. Is there a time frame for that?
I will get them out as soon as I can.
Then, when the time is there, it shall appear. So, Julian, thank you so much for enlightening the audiences on Writer's Series.